You know that feeling when you're deep in study, maybe even pulling an all-nighter, and you hit a wall? You jump online hoping for a clear answer, but instead you find yourself lost in a maze of conflicting information, some of it, frankly, looking a bit dodgy. Today, we're diving into a legal case that throws that exact problem into the spotlight. Marshall's Locksmith Service, Inc. v. Google, LLC. It's a fascinating exploration of what happens when online search results are supposedly manipulated by scams and who, well, carries the can.
That's right. You shared some really compelling material that highlights the tricky legal space surrounding online platforms. This deep dive will unpack a pivotal ruling on Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, a law that might not grab headlines, but it underpins so much of how the internet functions. We're going to look at how this law applies to search engines when they feature content created by outside parties, especially when that content could be fraudulent and demonstrably harm legitimate businesses. Our goal is to break down the core arguments of this case, get to grips with the court's thinking, and, ultimately understand where the lines are drawn when it comes to the legal immunity of online platforms.
Absolutely. And to get us there, you pointed us to some key resources. We'll be focusing on Pasted Text, which seems to be a mix of podcast guidance for a show called Decoding Digital Immunity, Marshall's Locksmith v. Google, alongside a detailed case brief of Marshall's Locksmith Service, Inc. v. Google, LLC. So it's like having both the executive summary and the in-depth legal analysis right here. This
Exactly.
should give us a really solid handle on the facts, the relevant legal framework, and what the court ultimately decided. Okay, let's unpack this. What was the central issue that triggered this whole legal battle?
Well, at its heart, the case revolves around something many of us take for granted: finding a local service online, in this case, locksmiths. Legitimate locksmith businesses allege that Google search results were being overwhelmingly populated by what they called scam locksmiths.
Scam locksmith.
Yeah, these weren't established local businesses. Often, they were fronts for out-of-state call centers that would dispatch subcontractors, sometimes unlicensed, and frequently at inflated prices. These scam operations used fake local addresses to appear prominently in search results.
So someone searches for a locksmith near me, thinking they're getting a reliable local pro, but they could end up with someone from far away, potentially overcharging them or even providing like subpar service. That sounds like a nightmare for consumers.
Absolutely.
But how did this directly impact the legitimate locksmiths?
Well, the locksmith companies that brought this lawsuit argued they were directly and negatively affected. Their genuine local listings were being pushed down in the search results, buried beneath this wave of fraudulent entries. They claimed that to even stand a chance of being seen by potential customers searching online, they were essentially forced to pay for Google Ads. It created a really problematic situation where legitimate businesses had to pay extra just to compete with the very scams that Google's platform was, in their view, helping to amplify.
It feels like a real catch-22 for these businesses.
Right.
They're reliant on the platform that's allegedly enabling their competitors.
Exactly. So the legitimate businesses are saying, Google, you're allowing these fake listings to thrive, and it's hurting our bottom line.
That leads us to the key question they were asking, right? Could Google be held responsible for the fact that these scam listings were so visible in their search results?
Precisely. And their argument wasn't just that Google was passively hosting this information. Their main contention was that Google was actively involved in making this fraudulent content more prominent. They argued that Google wasn't just a neutral platform. Their algorithms and the way they displayed information were actively amplifying the reach and impact of these scam listings. So what was the key legal argument the locksmiths were making against Google? They weren't just saying Google turned a blind eye. They were saying Google's own system was complicit in boosting the bad guys.
Okay, so they're not just claiming negligence, they're alleging a more active role by Google. Now, this is where the big legal principle comes into play. Section 230. Can you break down what this is and why it's so crucial in this case?
Absolutely. Section 230(c)(1) of the Communications Decency Act is really the bedrock of how online platforms are treated legally in the U.S. Essentially, it provides a legal shield, saying that online platforms generally shouldn't be held liable for content created and posted by their users or other third parties. Think of it as a fundamental "don't blame the messenger" rule for the internet.
So, if someone posts something false or harmful on a social media platform, generally the person who was harmed can't sue the platform itself. They have to go after the individual who actually created the post.
That's the core idea, yes. And to figure out if this immunity applies, courts often look at a three-part test. First, is the defendant an interactive computer service provider? For a massive platform like Google, that's clearly the case. They provide a service that allows users to interact with information online.
Uncontested, yeah.
Second, is the plaintiff trying to treat the defendant as a publisher or speaker of the information? In the Marshall's Locksmith case, the locksmiths were essentially arguing that by prominently featuring these scam listings, Google was acting like a publisher.
Okay, so they're trying to pin the publisher label on Google. What's the third critical part of this test?
The third, and often most decisive element, is whether the content in question originated from another information content provider. In this case, the fraudulent listings and the information within them were undeniably created by the scam locksmith operations, not by Google itself. Okay. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Section 230 immunity typically stands even when platforms use what are called neutral tools, things like algorithms, to organize, display, and even rank third-party content.
Neutral tools. Okay, so even if Google's algorithm played a significant role in making the scam listings appear high in search results, that doesn't automatically mean they lose their Section 230 protection.
Precisely. The court in this case really emphasized this point. They reasoned that Google's algorithms are designed to process and organize vast amounts of information from across the web. They're not intentionally creating the fraudulent information. They're just, you know, sifting and sorting what's already out there, even if the outcome isn't always perfect.
So the court sees Google as an automated translator of data, not the originator of the falsehood.
That's a good way to put it. That makes sense in theory. But the locksmiths argued that Google was doing more than just passively sorting, right? They specifically pointed to the map Pinpoints as an example. How did the court address that argument?
This is a crucial aspect of the court's reasoning and a really clear illustration of how they differentiate between simply processing third-party content and actually creating it. The plaintiffs argued that when Google took the addresses provided by the scam locksmith, say 123 Main Saint, and converted that into a visual map pin on Google Maps, that act constituted Google actively developing the fraudulent content.
I can see why they would argue that.
Yeah.
It's not just text on a web page, it's a visual element integrated into Google's own mapping service.
Exactly. However, the court didn't see it that way. They likened it to an automated translation of data. The scammer provides the address 123 Main Saint. Google system automatically takes that information and plots it on a map.
Uh-huh.
The court reasoned that Google isn't creating the address itself. They're simply taking the information provided by a third party and displaying it in a different format using a neutral automated process.
Right.
To really highlight this contrast, the court offered a hypothetical. If Google were to completely invent a fake locksmith address and display it on a map, that would very likely be considered Google creating the content, and Section 230 immunity would probably not apply.
Okay, that inventing an address example makes the distinction much clearer. So taking existing, even fraudulent information, and presenting it in a different way through an algorithm isn't enough to strip away that Section 230 shield.
Exactly.
What about the other arguments the locksmiths put forward? I recall reading something about Google being aware of the fraud.
Yes. The plaintiffs also argued that because Google was aware that these listings were likely scams, they should not be entitled to Section 230 immunity. However, the court firmly rejected this argument, citing well-established legal precedent, particularly the Zurin v. AOL case, which is a foundational ruling in Section 230 law.
Okay, Zurin.
The general principle here is that a platform's knowledge of illegal content usually doesn't negate their immunity. Courts are generally reluctant to make online platforms the arbiters of truth and the constant police force for everything posted on their sites. I mean, the sheer volume of online information makes that impractical and could really stifle free expression.
So even if Google had internal systems flagging these locksmith listings as potentially fraudulent, that didn't automatically make them liable for displaying them.
That's the core of it, according to the court's interpretation of Section 230. The focus remains on who originally created the content. As long as it came from a third party and Google's involvement was limited to organizing or displaying it through neutral means, the immunity generally holds.
Okay.
The plaintiffs also tried to argue that features like maps and lists, where the scam listings were presented, constituted enhanced formatting that went beyond simply displaying third-party content and amounted to Google developing it.
And the court rejected that argument as well, correct?
They did. The court reasoned that these features, the maps, the lists, the way the information was presented, were still fundamentally derived from the underlying third-party data and were generated through neutral automated tools. They weren't seen as Google adding their own original substantive content to the fraudulent listings.
So it really boils down to this crucial distinction between passively displaying or organizing third-party content versus actively creating or fabricating the harmful content themselves.
That's the key takeaway from the court's reasoning in this case. Now, it's important to remember that this immunity isn't absolute. The court did reiterate that if a platform were to actually fabricate content to invent a fraudulent locksmith business out of thin air, for example, then Section 230 protection would likely be lost because at that point, the platform would be acting as the information content provider.
That makes sense. What about the other legal claims the locksmiths tried to bring? I remember seeing something about antitrust.
Right. The plaintiffs also brought claims under the Sherman Act, alleging that Google was abusing its market power and engaging in a conspiracy to restrain trade. However, these claims were also unsuccessful. The court found that the plaintiffs hadn't presented a convincing case for a conspiracy between Google and the scam locksmiths.
Ah, no plausible conspiracy alleged.
There simply wasn't sufficient evidence to suggest an agreement aimed at harming legitimate businesses in this way.
And what about the state law claims, like fraud and unfair competition? Did those have any success?
Unfortunately for the plaintiffs, those claims were also largely preempted by Section 230's broad federal immunity. The general idea is that when a federal law provides such a strong shield against liability, related state laws that attempt to regulate the same conduct often can't stand in its way.
So across the board, Google was successful in this legal battle, largely due to the strength of Section 230.
Seems so.
What are the wider implications of this ruling for the internet and online platforms?
Well, the most significant implication is that this case really reinforces the very strong protection that Section 230 provides to online platforms when it comes to how they curate and display third-party content using algorithms. It sends a clear signal that courts are generally hesitant to hold platforms liable for the negative consequences of information created by others, even if those platforms play a role in its dissemination.
Essentially, Section 230 acts as a powerful "don't blame the messenger" rule for the internet.
But does this leave legitimate small businesses like these locksmiths in a really vulnerable position? If the dominant search engine isn't held responsible for amplifying scams that directly harm them, what options do they have? That seems like a significant issue.
That's precisely the critical question that this case brings to the forefront. Critics argue that this broad immunity, while originally intended to foster the growth of the internet and protect free speech, can also have unintended consequences, like making it incredibly difficult for legitimate businesses to fight back against scam-driven manipulation of online search results.
Right.
It forces us to consider whether the current interpretation of Section 230 strikes the right balance between protecting platforms and ensuring some level of accountability for the spread of harmful or fraudulent information.
It definitely feels like there's a real tension there. And with technology constantly evolving, how might future legal challenges try to redefine the boundaries of this neutral tools concept? I'm thinking about the rise of increasingly sophisticated AI-generated content.
It's a very insightful point. As AI becomes more deeply integrated into online platforms, generating summaries, powering chatbots, and even potentially creating synthetic media, future legal battles will likely explore whether these AI tools still qualify as neutral or if they cross the line into content creation or development by the platform itself.
Yeah.
It's a legal frontier that's going to be fascinating to watch unfold.
Absolutely. Now, let's revisit some of the fundamental legal concepts at play here. You mentioned the crucial distinction under Section 230 between a publisher and an information content provider. Can you elaborate on why that difference is so central to this case?
This is really at the heart of Section 230. The law essentially aims to protect online platforms from being treated as the publisher of information that originates from someone else, the information content provider.
Okay.
If a platform were legally considered a publisher, it could be held liable for a wide range of third-party content, much like a traditional newspaper might be liable for defamatory statements in its articles. Section 230 seeks to prevent this, fostering a more open and less legally risky online environment.
Right. Makes sense.
In the Marshall's locksmith case, the court consistently concluded that Google was acting more like a conduit or organizer of information provided by the scam locksmiths, rather than as the original creator or publisher of that fraudulent information itself.
And the neutral tools doctrine, how did that specifically apply in this situation?
The neutral tools doctrine is a key interpretation of Section 230. that essentially says the use of automated content-agnostic tools like Google search algorithms to organize, filter, or display third-party content doesn't typically lead to the loss of Section 230 immunity.
Got it.
The court in Marshall's Locksmith relied heavily on this, arguing that Google's algorithms, including those that generate map pinpoints, are neutral because they process all types of information without specifically targeting or creating the fraudulent nature of the locksmith listings. They don't inherently favor scams over legitimate businesses and how they operate. They simply process the data they receive.
You also mentioned the Fair Housing Council v. Roommates.com case as a contrast. Why is that comparison helpful for understanding the limits of Section 230 immunity?
Roommates.com is a really illustrative example of where Section 230 immunity can be lost. In that case, the platform required users to input discriminatory preferences when searching for roommates, things like excluding people based on race or family status.
Wow, okay.
The court found that Roommates.com was not protected by Section 230 because by requiring this discriminatory information as a condition of using the service, they were actively shaping and contributing to the creation of illegal discriminatory content.
So they were requiring the bad input.
Exactly. This is a key difference from Marshall's Locksmith, where Google's tools were seen as passively processing third-party data, regardless of its legality. The critical distinction is the level of active involvement by the platform in creating or requiring the specific problematic content.
That distinction makes the boundaries of Section 230 much clearer. So just to clarify some common misunderstandings, it's not accurate to say that platforms are automatically liable if they simply know about illegal content on their site.
Exactly. That's a common misconception. While there are ongoing debates about the responsibilities of platforms to address harmful content, under the current interpretation of Section 230, mere knowledge of illegal activity generally doesn't strip away immunity. The crucial factor is the platform's role in the actual creation or development of that content.
And just because a platform enhances the presentation of third-party data, like turning an address into a map pinpoint, that doesn't automatically mean they are legally considered to be creating the content itself?
Correct. Again, as long as those enhancements are derived from the underlying third-party data through neutral automated processes, they're generally protected under Section 230. The key is that the platform isn't adding its own original substantive information to the content in a way that contributes to its harmful or illegal nature.
Right. And earlier you said state law claims were preempted, which just means the federal law, Section 230, takes precedence here.
Precisely.
Okay, this has been a really insightful deep dive into a pretty complex area of law. So for you listening, the core takeaway from the Marshall's Locksmith case seems to be that Section 230 provides really significant legal protection to online platforms for how they organize and display information that comes from other people, even if that information turns out to be harmful or fraudulent. The crucial point for overcoming this immunity is generally going to be demonstrating that the platform itself actually created the illegal content rather than just curating or presenting it.
Precisely. And this case really underscores the ongoing balancing act between protecting the innovative and open nature of the internet and ensuring some level of accountability for the potential harms that can arise from third-party content online.
It certainly does. And it leaves us with a final provocative thought. Given the relentless evolution of online scams and the ever-increasing sophistication of platform algorithms, does the current interpretation of Section 230 truly strike the right balance? Does it adequately protect free speech while also ensuring accountability for the spread of harmful or fraudulent information, especially for those vulnerable entities like small businesses who can be significantly impacted?
That's the big question, isn't it?
This case really offers a critical lens through which to consider the future of internet law. And just where the responsibilities of these powerful online platforms should ultimately lie. It's definitely something for all of us to keep considering.